Get after it, PDX. In-depth conversations with inspiring people in the creative hotbed of Portland, Oregon, and beyond. Now, let's welcome the host of Get After It PDX and the co-founder of Y East Wolfpack, Willie McBride.
Hey folks, a quick word about our sponsors. The Amesir Distilling Company, a new distillery focused on bringing people together through great flavors and a warm environment. They love the way spirits taste, but more importantly, they love that they bring people together to make memories, build bridges, and crystallize the moment. Opening in spring 2020 in Northeast Portland. Today's episode is also brought to you by Daybreak Racing, a Portland, Oregon company offering some of the finest trail running events and trail stewardship opportunities available today. Daybreak Racing has been uniting the adventurous and wild-hearted with the mountain, coast, and forest trails of the Pacific Northwest since 2016. Adventure begins at Daybreak. Visit them at daybreakracing.com.
Special, and going along with that, we have another very special guest, Amanda Gillum, who is on the East Coast. So this is a Get After It PDX and Beyond. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. So you are founder and creator of Big Girl Barbell, which we can have you explain it in your own words. What is Big Girl Barbell?
Big Girl Barbell is a community. It started as an Instagram community. For women, girls, and non-binary folks who are classified as heavyweights or super heavyweights in strength sports. So think things like weightlifting, powerlifting, CrossFit, for example. We even have some folks that participate in the Highland Games that are in our community as well. So it's for the big people of strength sports.
And so you said you're located in New Jersey, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is that, like we always do with our guests, we like to go back in the day and hear your whole story, see the progression of how you got to be doing what you're doing today. So let's do that. Where were you born and raised?
I consider myself a southerner at heart. I was born in Martinsville, Virginia, which is a very small rural town in Southwest Virginia. We lived there until I was about 8. Then we moved to North Carolina in Winston-Salem for a year or so. And then my father took another job at Anheuser-Busch in Newark. So that's the people that make Budweiser and all the beers. So I've been in New Jersey, I guess, for 30 years, but I feel like my heart is still in the South. That's where all my relatives are. That's the way I speak. And that just kind of feels like where my heart is. But yes, I've been in New Jersey for 30 years now.
So most of your childhood, like school and high school, that was all?
That was here. Yep.
In Newark?
No, we live in Somerset, New Jersey. So it's kind of central New Jersey. There's a debate between what is south and central and north, but we are firmly in central New Jersey.
So I've been asked people like, in high school, what were you interested in? What were your hobbies? What were you, maybe if somebody had asked you, what did you wanted to be when you grew up? What might it be?
So my crew was the nerd crew. I will proudly own that. But like the cool side of the nerd crew. So not the dorks and the dweebs, but just like the cool nerds, I think, is where I was. I think I wanted to be everything when I grow up. If you ask me that today, I might have a different answer still. But I always wanted to be an attorney and maybe do something in politics. I really like fighting for the underdog or people who don't get a lot of representation or have access to power or a strong voice. And I think that's kind of mirrored in the work that I do in strength sports as well, because no one thinks about the super heavyweights. So.
So I'll just jump around here on your Instagram, which is, like you said, Big Girl Barbell started social media thing on Instagram. On your personal page, you also list as who you are as a scholar and an activist besides founder and creator of Big Brother. Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, when did your interest in activism or, you know, social justice, fighting for the underdog, like you just said, when did that start coming into your life? Was that from an early age you had those feelings?
I mean, I would probably say like preschool. My mom loves to tell a story. There used to be this like capital letter T with a little chain around it, and you'd have to wear it if you tattletaled a lot. So it was called the tattletale T, and I was always wearing it at preschool. Not to tattletale on people, but to say, hey, this isn't right. This person did this. It made this girl sad. So I think I've always been that person, even since preschool. But then obviously growing up in a Black family, we've had, you know, those kinds of discussions. They've been a part of my life since I was young. You have to prepare Black children to go out into a white world. So I think that that's always sort of been part of my story as well. In terms of like actual activism, when I was in high school, I actually joined a volunteer project with the ACLU. And at the time, there was a lot of outrage around New Jersey State Police stops and racial profiling. So we were trying to prove that there was a pattern of state trooper stops up and down the turnpike, which is also Interstate 95. So when I think about this now, like 25 years later, I'm like, what are my parents thinking? But I got into a car with a random man who works for the ACLU, right? And we would just ride up and down 95, cataloging all the New Jersey State Trooper stops. And what we did with that data was, you know, we just take some visual observations of who they stopped. What ended up happening with that data was it went into a project to study New Jersey State Police racial profiling and traffic stops. So in terms of like actual projects that I've done, I think I've been doing those sorts of things since high school. In college, I was a part of the activist crew as well. So we were always sort of doing disruptions and walkouts and, you know, turning our backs to speakers, those sorts of things. And now, you know, I'm far past my college days, but I actually do some immigrant advocacy work in New Jersey and in New York City. I accompany immigrants who are going for political asylum cases before federal courts, just as a show of support so that the judge and other folks know that these are people who are loved, who have community that care about them. Trying to bring those issues sort of out of the dark and behind closed doors into the light where we can bear witness to those things. So that's where I'm kind of at in my activism for right now.
What year was the project about the police force and profiling?
That would have been 97, I think, 1997.
It's funny, obviously that stuff happens all the time, but I do remember years and years and years ago an article. Yeah, it sounds stupid, but it was in Vanity Fair or some like magazine like that. Mm-hmm. It was about, I feel like it was about New Jersey police doing racial profiling.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. So that was me as a high school student working on that project.
Wow, that's awesome. And were you, obviously now athletics is a big part of your life. Mm-hmm. What relationship to athletics did you have as a young person in your childhood or in high school?
Not really much. Like in high school and in junior high, I was in band. So I did marching band in high school. I did do softball for like a season. That wasn't great. I think I was on JV. And then I ran track for like half a season senior year, doing some distance running. But like athletics, I enjoyed watching it, but it hasn't been something that I was ever really involved in. So having those experiences now and finding a way into sports and thinking about like what my athletic potential could be has been a really interesting experience for me, because I don't really have anything to draw upon. Also, I'm old, I'm 40. So I'm actually a master's athlete at this point. So I kind of feel like I'm, every day I step in the gym, I feel like I'm learning something new for the first time, just because I don't have that history and that background to draw upon.
38 going on 39, so we're right there.
Yeah.
Right there with you. So one thing I want to touch on that caught my ear is, but clearly right now we're in a unique time in the world, in history, for many reasons. There's a lot of stuff going on. So in terms of social justice and Black Lives Matter and all those sort of overlapping and related issues, obviously those things have been going on forever in this country, but now it does seem like a very unique time in that it seems like more than ever those things are actually being talked about, and there is some amount of real change occurring or shift in at least people's dialogue around this stuff. So clearly being those times, we do want to talk about that stuff and continue to facilitate dialogue around that and use our platform for those purposes. So the thing that caught my ear was, you said, you know, the reality of growing up in a Black family and them preparing a Black kid to grow up in a white world. So obviously, like, in some very upsetting ways, we know, especially now, what that means. It's like teaching a Black kid who, like, what their relationship with police might be. But from your experience, being a person of color, woman of color, what does that mean for you and your family, being raised to be in a white world? Did you illuminate that?
I mean, I feel like, you know, probably the police question is one of the most highly visible ways that we can have this conversation. But, you know, the reality of Black life is that these things play out on so many different axes. I just have so many stories of things that have happened in my life. But you know, I think one of the things that Black parents and Black families deal with, just in terms of like schoolwork, like I was an academic superstar. I still am. But you almost have to be, because you have to put in like my 100% effort is probably, you know, I feel like I always feel like I have to put in 130% effort to sort of counteract people's low expectations of me, or even just to be like 100% foolproof, so no one can ever come back to me and say I didn't do X, Y, and Z things. So I think it plays out professionally. I just read an article. There's a new concept called pet to threat, and it deals with when Black coworkers go from being like the pet in the office to being a threat, which is, you know, I don't know, when we assert our dignity and professional knowledge. I've experienced that in the workplace. So we see it in schools, we see it with police, just even in terms of navigating daily life. I'll never forget, I was in Macy's with my husband, like just looking at the watch cases, and there was a white child who was probably like 8 years old with her mother, standing near her packages, and she turns around, she sees me, she looks at her package, and then she goes and stands in front of her package and blocks it. And I'm just like, this is a child, this is an 8-year-old child, where is this stuff coming from? So, you know, the police is probably the most visible way, but it has played out in so many ways. I've even had troubles adopting dogs, and I come with, like, I've owned bully breeds. I come ready for that conversation, and it's just all these weird kind of ways that these things play out. And they also play out in the gym space. Like, the gym is a highly contested space, especially for Black bodies. So, I mean, it's in everything, and in things that people probably wouldn't even think to find it in.
Well, let's continue that conversation, talking about it being prevalent even in a gym, so to speak. And that's definitely something that, because, you know, I've been into, you know, outdoor sports and athletics for many, many years, specifically outdoor stuff, and loving that, that sense of freedom and, you know, connecting with nature feels so great. And it's easy to think that it's so equitable or like, hey, it's nature, right? It's free. It's, why wouldn't somebody feel comfortable here or equal here, right? Because it's just nature. But like in that realm, over the past few years, I've really opened my eyes to like how not equitable it is, and especially or reinforced through lack of representation and all these things. So extending that, I think it'd be easy for some to think like, well, hey, like a gym or lifting weights or something like that should be simple, right? It's open to whoever. But tell us then about your experience. How has that not been the case in the gym space?
So I'll say this. So getting involved in CrossFit. So I'm coming to this as a Black woman, but I'm also coming to this as a fat Black woman. So you've got like two things kind of rubbing against the reality of the situation where Black folks might not be welcome, but also fat people aren't welcome. So if you put two things together, I think it creates, you know, a lot of sparks. So I had originally been interested in CrossFit. I think maybe like as early as 2011, I was working in Washington, D.C., doing research for graduate school. And I said, oh, okay, let me go try this out. I know some friends that do it. I went, it wasn't very welcoming at all. I had like a demo session with one of the coaches, put it away, filed it away, said this won't be for me. In 2012, my father passed away unexpectedly. And I was just kind of like in a repeat cycle of get up, eat, sleep, cry, get up, cry, sleep, eat, like for months on end. I said, okay, I got to do something else with my time. And there was a local CrossFit by me that had a Groupon. I know my brother was doing it, so he said, just go try it out. Turns out the owner of that CrossFit was actually a Korean-American man who had grown up in South Korea, but then also had, you know, grown up in his teenage years in Newark, New Jersey. And just kind of had like a good sense about him. I felt like he was culturally relevant to me, and I felt safe and protected in that space. So as far as being a Black person in that space, that was a very diverse gym. It was owned by a man of color. I felt great and confident there. I ended up getting injured, took some time off from the gym. When I was feeling better, I was ready to reintegrate into the gym space. And just trying to find one that either wasn't completely white, didn't have like those thin blue line flags on the wall, which I have only seen used in relationship to Black Lives Matter the first time around, like 5 years ago. I feel like there's lots of ways that gyms communicate messages without ever having to say things. So
is that like basically Blue Lives Matter?
Yeah, it's like the Blue Lives Matter flag with a little thin blue line on it. So anytime I see those, I'm like, I don't know why you put this up. I don't know if there's a gym full of cops. I don't know if you're anti-Black Lives Matter. And furthermore, I don't have energy to figure it out. So there are lots of gyms that I just bypassed on because I don't need that in my gym space. But I've recently, so the gym I ended up finding in 2016 was run by a Black man who was a national level athlete, originally from Africa, from Ghana. The population was so diverse. I felt welcomed and I felt included as both a Black woman and as a fat Black woman. And that's sort of been the scene since. I'm now at a different gym, but again, it's a space where I feel not only welcome, but cared for and provided for as an athlete.
So, were there gyms prior to finding this gym that actually was a good fit that, or have you had other experiences where it was clear that because either of your skin color or because of your body size that you weren't welcome as much, or it just felt that
way? I haven't, because one, I think I'm old enough where I just don't tolerate that type of nonsense. So you won't even get me to come in and give something a try unless I feel confident and okay with it. So before I join any gym or visit any gym, I'm already doing like background research. I'm looking at the photos. I'm going on the website. I'm seeing if the coach is on Facebook, what kind of stuff are they posting on their personal page? I'm looking at their Instagram. This is part of a safety plan. It's part of my personal safety plan, but I think it's also probably a safety plan for a lot of Black people and certainly for a lot of fat athletes. We have these kinds of conversations. Is there diet culture messaging? Is this all about weight loss? Like, how can I safely fit into this space? So that's part of my research process before I do that. But I can say, as a fat Black athlete, I know that these things are in place. And even though I've had good experiences or been able to find other gyms, probably because I live in New Jersey and we have everything, that everybody isn't able to do that with as much ease and with as much know-how and with as much confidence either. So I think it's partly who I am as a person, and then partly just what I have access to living where I do.
And sorry, not everyone has the ability to do as much previous research.
Yeah, like, just doesn't have access to things. So sometimes I will talk to athletes where there's only one weightlifting or powerlifting gym within 20 miles. I have like 15 of those gyms within 20 miles.
You are discerning about what.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So again, we're going to jump around a little bit here. Mm-hmm. So you said, like, you know, early on in your life, like high school, you did some athletics, but that wasn't like a focus like it is now.
Right.
And so when, so let's just keep going in chronological order from high school. Mm-hmm. What came after high school?
I went to college, and I just got really into activist spaces. Like, within 3 weeks there, I had created a Gay Straight Alliance. And then I just kind of went down that path. I was really involved in queer community and activism around those kinds of issues, and also just around race and class. I went to Dartmouth College, which is like Ivy League, old money, and probably the most conservative out of all of those schools. So it's almost like kind of stepping into a time warp, and also being not those things. Like, I'm not white, I'm not old money, and I'm not conservative. So I was always trying to carve out a space for myself on that campus. And so that's where a lot of the activism and interest that I had at college came for, just trying to find community and make it a place where I could actually live, survive, and thrive for 4 years.
So I'd imagine in a lot of the spaces you would be in, that there's not a lot of people that look like you.
There's not.
That, I mean, so obviously for some people that would be something that might make them super duper self-conscious, of course, mm-hmm. or sort of recede into themselves or be, you know, not confident about that. What was your experience? Like, did that cause those type of emotions, or did it empower you? You know, obviously people would react differently mm-hmm. to the other, or, you know, situationally as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure. So what was your experience?
My mom was born in 1954, which was the year that Brown versus Board of Education dropped for desegregation. Her town, also a small rural town in Virginia, didn't really start integrating until like a decade after that. So I think we think of these decisions as immediate, but it's really like a trickle-down effect. So my mom actually was the entering class that desegregated her middle school. So I'm coming from a stock of people who have had those similar experiences. My father was bused across Hampton, Virginia to integrate their city schools. So this is something like this being the only one in the room, this being the first to do something, this is a part of my family's history, and I'm not typically intimidated by those types of things, because I've seen people who I love very dearly do it and do it successfully. But also, I think part of that is also, like, I'm not special because I'm the only one in the room. There's forces that are making me one of the only ones in the room. And it doesn't mean that I've got person who was sort of like let through the gates. So I think we have to think of it that way as well. Still, that said, I do feel empowered by that, because if you get one person in the door, that person can open the door for everybody else. And that's how I've always sort of viewed things, whether it's, you know, one of two Black people in the AP classes, or, you know, this gym doesn't have a lot of super heavyweights, so I'm going to represent for the big girls. Like, I'm okay in that role, but I never want to stay in that role, because I want other people to come and to join me. But I do find power from that. I actually find a lot of power from that.
So you said a lot of activism in college throughout, doing these different things. That was still pre really getting into your athletic life. So what sort of came, so activism all through college, and then what followed that?
I worked for a couple of years, long-term tip assignments in New York at various law firms. When I was in college, I created a creative writing program for people in prison, because I was an English major and creative writing major, and I got really into prison literature, and was trying to like bring my interest in policing and mass incarceration together with my creative pursuits. So in college, I created a creative writing program that I taught at different jails and prisons here in New Jersey. After I graduated, I thought, okay, I'll just continue to teach this, and maybe I'll go to grad school and get a PhD in something similar. So I worked for a couple of years, taught my program, and then did get into a PhD program in cultural anthropology at Columbia. Like, okay, I'm going to keep doing my prison thing. But by that point, it just sounds terrible, but by this point, I was just kind of burnt out on the topic. So if you think I've been doing it since I was like 17, riding up and down the turnpike, by the time I got to grad school, I think I was 25, and I just needed a change of pace. So I broadened my topic a little bit, started thinking about Black studies, Black feminism, and actually found my way to fat activism, because they bring together lots of these things. They bring together class, it brings together race, it brings together sexuality. So I was like, all right, so at the time there was this burgeoning field called fat studies. And it's like ethnic studies for fat folks. And I was like, okay, well, I'll do a project that looks at the relationship between anti-Blackness and anti-fatness. So that's what I was doing in grad school for many, many years. On the side, so like 2012, 2013, I got into CrossFit. And so now I was sort of living, you know, as a fat person, but as a fat person who's in this contested space of the gym. So as my dissertation and PhD dream sort of took a very long detour, I got more and more interested in gym culture, and thinking about the ways that I could apply some of these academic ideas about bodies, about race and belonging, to the experiences that I was having in the gym. And so that's kind of what brought me to that.
That is fascinating. So have you written up like a big thesis or a book or something?
I have 4 chapters of what was probably going to be 7 chapters. I don't know what I will do with it now, because I dropped out of my PhD program. I could return theoretically. I feel like my heart is maybe somewhere else. I am still interested in the law, law school, but I don't know. It's funny, because when I was doing this project, I started grad school in 2005, like, not too many people were thinking about fatness, and if they were, it was in the UK and Australia. And I remember when I did my qualifying exams, I was like, all right, well, here's what I want to do. And one of my professors was like, is this a thing? Can you actually do this research that you're talking about? And literally just 2 months ago, someone proposed a similar project. And I was like, wow, maybe I was just like 10 years too early on that wave. So I've had these interests for a very long time. But some, I tend to get bored sometimes with things. So I feel like even though I've got these 3 or 4 really dope chapters of the dissertation, I'm thinking of new ways that I might repurpose the material that's more in line with like my goals and who I am as a person right now.
I think anyone who does athletics can sort of agree that there's many benefits. You know, there's sort of the stress relief and therapy element often, but what was it for you through that time that you really connected with, or maybe in general with athletics, but then with like weightlifting in general, what about weightlifting did you like so much?
I mean, I think when I first started CrossFit, the draw was I could meet new people who didn't know I had a father beforehand. Like I was deep in grief, like unimaginable levels of grief. And so what was great about having that experience after he died was that these were all new people who didn't know that story. And I kind of felt like I could almost reinvent myself or start this next part of my life over. But I also really liked the challenge. And I'll talk about this a little bit with weightlifting as well. But like, as we were talking about before, I'm really good at lots of things. And I don't mean that in like a like conceited kind of like self-important way. I just mean that I really put my all into things and I see how far I can go with it. And I try to do the highest level of the thing that I can do. So I'm really good at academics. I've done lots of great things with activism, but with this athletic space, like things were hard for me. There were things in CrossFit that I still can't do. Like we have these box jumps where you have to jump on a box. I have never done a box jump in my life. I'm scared to do it. I believe that feet belong on the floor. Like I just won't ever do it. They do lots of pull-ups, and it took me like a year to be able just to dead hang my entire body from a pull-up bar. So there are things in the space that do not come easy to me and that I have to continue working for. But everything else comes easy to me. So that has been, that's one of the things I really liked about it, was that I wasn't good. And I had to really try, and I had to try over an extended amount of time. There's a lot of times like big folks who used to do CrossFit but now do weightlifting, you know, will say, oh, I don't have to do the cardio now. I didn't have a problem with running. I loved running. I didn't have a problem with the jump roping. But I really just looked to weightlifting really because of the injury, and I couldn't do the things that I used to like about CrossFit. What I really like about weightlifting is the competitive side of it. And at my first competition, you know, I'm in the venue and I just go to take a look at the platform that's raised up on a stage. And I looked at it and I was like, oh, this is just a stage. And I like to perform for people, so I can do this. And at that moment, like every worry I ever had about competing just went away. So I honestly, for weightlifting, I like the showmanship of it. I like that you can go out and put on a performance for people and have them enjoy what you're doing. So that's one of the things that I like about weightlifting the most.
So you compete on a regular, somewhat regular basis?
I wouldn't say regular. So my first competition, I want to say, was November 2016. And I just started weightlifting in May of 2016, like weightlifting only. Then I did a competition in April 2017, and then I did big competition July of 2017. I completely sucked, completely choked. It was like on a national level stage. I went 2 for 6. Like, it was just so terrible. Like, it's so terrible when I think about how terrible it was. And I haven't competed since. In the meantime, I've also switched gyms. But now no one's competing because of coronavirus. So I wouldn't say I compete regularly, but once things are back to normal, that is definitely my goal, is to get back out. I mean, in my CrossFit gym, I was definitely the biggest person there, which was fine, but, you know, I was doing my thing. But I had thought about it, like, I'm, like, really hyper-visible in this space because of my body. But then also just sort of looking at CrossFit culture also felt very invisible.
Because tell me about the evolution of the idea of Big Girl Barbell and creating that space in that community for other folks.
So, I mean, in my CrossFit gym, I was definitely the biggest person there, which was fine, but, you know, I was doing my thing. But I had thought about it, like, I'm, like, really hyper-visible in this space because of my body. But then also just sort of looking at CrossFit culture also felt very invisible because you don't really see, you might see big girls in CrossFit, like big muscular, obviously muscular girls, but you don't see like big girls, like fat girls. So it was just something that was kind of in the back of my mind. Once I decided on doing weightlifting as a thing, suddenly weightlifting is divided into weight categories. So at that time, the highest weight category was 75 kilos plus. So it was everyone who was over 75 kilos. So that could look like me, and it could also look like somebody who's 76 kilos. So there was a huge range of body sizes there. And I remember my second competition, they had up the weight categories to now the highest was 90 kilos plus. And a woman came up to me and she said, oh, you must be one of the other 90s. And I was just like, how did she know? I mean, like, obviously she knows. I'm sitting right there and she can look at me. But I just remember thinking like, oh, wow, this woman has come across the room and found me because I'm like her and we're in the same weight class. And that just sort of like put a light bulb off in my head. What if I can create a space where we can all find each other? In commune and talk to each other and encourage each other when we're in this space where we're super visible because we're obviously big, but also invisible because we're super heavyweights and it doesn't really feel like people are checking for us and what we're doing in the sport. And so that's where the idea came from.
So then what, so the idea was what, just to say, I want to start an Instagram account that just starts showing.
I want to start a community where I can see and be with other people who look like me. So Instagram, I think, was the easiest place there at that time because people post videos of their lifts and you can see people. So I remember telling my cousin about this idea, and she's like, total boss woman, like, top of her field, multinational company. So I was like, I tell her, it's either going to go one of two ways, no, or oh my God, you better do this right now. So obviously it went to, oh my God, you better do this right now. And because she's such a boss lady, she's like, let's have dinner. Let's talk about it. I need to see your mission statement. You need to come up with a graphic, like all of these things. So as soon as I told her, I'm like, all right, I got to do it or else she's going to, you know, kick my butt. So, yeah, so I did it and I created it. And so my goal was to debut this thing at the nationals competition that I was in July. And it turned out that the Pan Ams were taking place at the same competition. So these are like Olympic athletes. We're going to be at the Pan Ams right before this next competition, the American Open, started. So I was like, well, if I take my little cards with Big Girl Barbell on them and our mission statement, and I take them to the Pan Ams, that makes it real. So I was trying to get some accountability to myself. So I get there to the competition. Sarah Robles is there, who is an award medal-winning Olympian, super heavyweight in weightlifting. She's sitting there, and I'm like, oh my God, it's Sarah Robles. Okay, let me just get out my little brochure. And so I go, and I'm like, oh my God, I love you. I'm doing this thing. Did you just read about it? And then I like kind of left because I was so scared. And she reads and she's like, oh, stand up. So I was like, okay, now I've told an Olympian super heavyweight. So now I really got to like do this thing. So some of my first posts on Big Girl Barbell was me with Sarah and a couple other really high level athletes that were at that competition. And then I just kind of would put them out on Instagram and look up different hashtags and try to find lifters that seemed like they were super heavyweight to me. I'd slide in the DMs, tell them what I was working on, and see if they wanted to be a part of it. My whole thing was consent. Sometimes you'll get on Instagram and people repost things without talking to people. It doesn't bother me personally, but I knew I wanted to proceed from a point of consent. So any athlete who had a video that I would have liked to have shown on the page, I really spent, an hour or two each day messaging with them, talking about them, introducing myself, seeing where they lived, what their lifting story was, and then asking if we could repost the content. So this is people who follow the account or people who want to be there and who believe in the stuff that we're doing and who really appreciate the power of that community.
And what was your mission statement straight up?
Oh gosh, what was it? It's something it's a space for, I've since changed it, but I think the first thing was that it's a space for the super weight, super heavyweight women and girls of strength sports to increase representation, encourage each other, and offer support, which was great for when my cousin was on me to come up with something. I think my ideas have evolved a little bit. I used to have this thing on the Instagram called Feature Friday, and I would work with an athlete to just give me a couple of paragraphs about their lifting story, and then they would, post a video. And at the time I had a person named Aisha, who's actually become just a really dear friend. She wrote one, and I think one of the lines in her paragraph was something like, "I don't exist for the thin gaze." And I was just like, "You're damn right we don't exist for the thin gaze." So I know a lot of work in social justice is about visibility and representation. But I want to be clear that we're not bringing this community together so that people can sort of gawk and watch from the sidelines. This is really just for us and by us. And we don't care what people who are not in this community really think about us or have to say, even if it's great job, good, I love what you're doing. We're not there for those people. I'm here for the people in my community. So I think my mission has changed a bit since those early days, but this is really just for us. And I can see on Instagram now, people who are in my community, how they've connected with other people outside of the Instagram page. Friendships and relationships have gone, real life. It's just really amazing to watch. And it's been amazing to watch people either excel in lifting or move on from lifting and do other great things. And I think that's one of the powers of strength sports, is that it really does build you up and make you strong to do other things that may far surpass whatever goes on in the gym.
Where do you see the future going with it? Do you have different ideas of what that could be, or different aspirations on ways it could develop?
I do. So I think my ultimate goal was always real in-person community connection. That's always what I wanted. And I've been making that happen in little ways. So I created the account in 2017. Every year Arnold Schwarzenegger holds the Arnold in Columbus, Ohio, here in the States. So he's there, and it's everybody in strength sports, powerlifters, Highlands Games people, CrossFitters are there, weightlifters, bodybuilders. It's just the industry standard. So I became real life in 2018 and went to that event as Big Girl Barbell and watched people in my community compete in different sports. That was a huge step for me because I'm an introvert. So I really had to set myself up in my hotel room to put on the Big Girl Barbell shirt and go downstairs and talk to people in real life that I may have only talked to through Instagram and DMs. But I liked having that connection with people. It was great to see people as like actual people and not, you know, screen names. So I thought, you know, I really wish this could go live and be like an in-person community. And so last year, September 2019, I was invited to give a workshop at Radical Health Alliance's Fat Camp. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's camp for fat folks where we can just be fat and have fun camp activities. So we met in Minnesota. We did all sorts of fun camp stuff. And I had a workshop that I ran that was, I think it was called like Lifting as Liberation, finding community through strength sports. And I actually led a weightlifting workshop for the folks that were at Fat Camp. It was 90 minutes, but it is probably like one of the best things that I've done in my adult life, just connecting with people, introducing a sport that a lot of people had wanted to do but weren't sure if they had a place in. There were some lifters there who had lifted before, but were moving on from their gyms. So I was just like, this is the thing that I want to do with Big Girl Barbell. And so as it happened, when I got back home, I was like, all right, let me just post this little meetup and I'll just post the pictures. And as soon as I posted it, like the DM started flying. Hey, I want you to come in and do this workshop. Hey, we'd love to host you at this gym. Hey, we'd love to have you come out here. And again, as an introvert, I'm like, yay, but also like, oh my God, what have I done? Now I have to like talk to all these other people. So the plan was like, I was like, okay, let me get through my busy season at work. At the time I was working in college admissions. So I was like, let me get through the fall. Then, you know, in the new year, we'll talk about it. We'll set some things up. What happens in the new year? We've got coronavirus. So things are kind of at a standstill for now until we can figure out what safely getting back in the gym might look like. But my goals are to do in-person meetups. I would love to be able to certify gyms as like fat-friendly so that the people who are in my community know that they can go to this gym and be welcomed and supported and loved on in the body that they have now without having to change. I have big goals, but we'll see what COVID-19 has in store for us for the rest of the year.
Have you been ever asked to like speak, or is it all like sort of clinic type stuff? Or
no, I did just do a, this was also through Radical Health Alliance. They did an online conference called Braving Body Shame. And that happened, I think, a little bit earlier this year in March. So I talked about gym culture and race for that, using my experiences with Big Girl Barbell. I'm also doing another podcast this week to talk about race and fitness culture. So I think there's academic potential for this topic, but there's also clinic-based stuff. And then there's also activism around this idea of bodies and gym culture as well. But I love it because I kind of get to continue doing some of the stuff that I started in my dissertation, just doing it in a new way through sports and athletics.
And so you said activism to be done around these issues?
Okay. Yeah, there is. There's definitely tons of things to do around these issues.
Let's talk about that. What?
I mean, there's a part of me that wants to say that, like, fitness culture is coming to terms with the fact that you can decouple weight loss from fitness. I think that's huge. It seems from what I'm seeing that there are increased numbers of trainers who are operating from like weight neutral or body neutral positions. There's also just straight out fat positive trainers who, you know, are embracing fat folks in the gym. So I think that there's whatever activism we've done in that space is working. I think people are starting to interrogate so-called common sense around body size, fitness, and health. But I do think that there's still lots of work to be done, even in terms of like representation. Like representation's huge. Who's representing your gym? What bodies do people see? What do people look like? Do you engage fat folks in your marketing? Does it only look like they're there to lose weight? Are you only showing before and afters? Like, are your trainers qualified to work with a range of bodies? Those sorts of things. So I think there's a lot of work to still be done in that space, but it's changing.
One question that also sort of ties into pertinent topics and a lot of, is a question in general related to these current topics for many people is how to be an ally. I'm always struggling with terminology, like, of course, because we want to like give proper respect and baggage with words and all this. Is so what, like you said, like big bodies, fat bodies, what, how do you officially sort of refer to yourself? Or
I refer to myself as fat. I recognize that everybody's not there yet, and I recognize that everybody won't be there yet. But they'll never be there, and that words carry different meanings in different communities. So I'm also comfortable with words like plus size, big bodies, heavy weights. I think it's context specific, but I'm not a fan of euphemisms. Just say it and say it with your chest. So I'm a fat person. I don't have a problem saying that. But I think we have to be sensitive to where people are, because you also don't want to turn people off with language. So if we think about that sort of question in terms of how to be an ally or how to make spaces more welcoming, I think language might be a huge part of it. There's also ways that like fat folks in fitness culture are used as like inspiration porn. That's what the disabled community would call it. So like, look at this fat person go, rah, 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 you go, you're laughing everyone on the couch, that's a good one. Like, you know, people being incredulous when fat people can accomplish things in the gym. So I think also just thinking about, even for gyms who might have fat people in the gym, or who may have bigger athletes in the gym, how are you showing them? Is it because you're so surprised that they were able to do this thing? Or are they just like everybody else, accomplishing the workout and the goals that were set for the session? And thank goodness in all of my gym experiences, I haven't experienced things like that. But I know that's not the case for everyone. There's also like, you know, how are you welcoming people into the space? Are you making assumptions about what they want to do? Are you assuming that they want to lose weight? Are you assuming that their goals are all about the way that their body looks? Even like what the present definition of fitness? Like there's so many places where things can go really wrong, or they can go really right and open up gym spaces to people who don't typically get a lot of shine and a lot of visibility there.
Well, I would assume that there's, even within so-called supporters of the movement, there's different opinions on, because like, I would sort of think that the point, I think we'd be agreeing, of course, in a lot of ways, that the point is not, or that it's damaging for people to look towards bigger bodies or fat bodies working out as they must just be intending to lose weight, because the goal should be not to be fat. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not the goal. Or the ultimate goal should be to accept that there's just a diversity of body types. Mm-hmm. Okay. Big bodies can be athletic, and thin bodies can be athletic, and whatever, mm-hmm. be athletic. Right? Is that, that's the bigger sort of point.
Yeah.
It's not always losing weight, because if that's what you think the goal always is, then that is implying that being fat is bad or negative, and something should be changed.
Right.
that's not necessarily the case.
Right. I would agree with you. One of the things I was thinking about this before, being in like a weightlifting space or just like a competitive strength sports space, is that as a super heavyweight, you're exempted from a lot of the rituals around that, around competition, one of which is cutting weight. So I remember when we did this competition in Miami, like all my teammates had to make sure they hit that number for weigh-in before the competition. So we've got people drinking water, people going to the sauna, burgers with no buns, and I'm just there at dinner, like, chowing down, like, getting into it, because I don't have to make weight, like, I need to show up for the competition. So it's been interesting to see, to, like, there's ways in which there's totally a space for fat bodies and bigger people in strength sports, but then there's also a way that we kind of experience some of those rituals from the outside because they don't apply to us in a lot of ways. So you kind of get like this dual experience of being in, but also being a little bit outside of the full experience.
So I got two more questions for you. So obviously life always has the tendency to throw us curveballs and stuff and different challenges here and there, which we clearly can see with this 2020 year so far.
Yeah.
But that aside, up to this point, you seem like a very confident, strong person who's, crushed a lot of challenges in your life. But what maybe were some of the notable hardest points, or like, were there points where you, or maybe, maybe in the work or with Big Girl Barbell, did you have times where you ever wavered in your drive towards accomplishing your goals, or, doubt yourself, or somebody did something that caused you to have doubt in yourself and then you pushed through? Curious if you had stumbling blocks and how you pushed through.
Just with Big Girl Barbell or like in general?
Just in general as well, yeah.
I mean, probably like graduate school, just seeing that kind of evaporate. I had originally wanted to do a joint program, so you could do a JD and get your law degree and also get a PhD. But I ended up getting into one of the four programs I applied to. And at Columbia, you could only do like a JD PhD in like political science and history, but not anthro, or not the field I was interested in. I said, okay, I'll go get my PhD and then I'll get the JD later. But it was just really hard. Like, we talk about being the first person in a room, I think the first person in my family to pursue like a terminal degree. So just did not have that kind of experience to draw upon. It was really difficult. And it's hard when people haven't had your experience and see you doing things because they don't quite get it. So I was like, no, really, I just have to read. I go to class a couple times a week and then I have to produce things. So it was hard. My dissertation sponsor ended up not getting tenure and having to move overseas for departmental politics reasons. So then I was there without my person, trying to make a go at this. And then on top of that, my father died right when I was starting my field work. But I'm a person who, I'm going to do something, I'm going to stick with it. Like, I'm not going to quit because I'm not a quitter, right? But I just stayed in that program way too long and past the point where I knew I probably should just leave and do something else. But I'm not a quitter, and I'm the first person in my family to do it, so of course I got to do it. And I'm Black, and what happens to all the other Black people that might come to this program? You take all the weight and put it on your shoulders. So eventually dropping out of that program and watching it all fall away, it was really upsetting. People in my family were upset with me. It was just really bad, and I ended up starting therapy because I just felt like I had no self-worth because I'm so wrapped up in my academic potential. So not having come out of that with the PhD was really, really damaging and difficult for me. But I'm on the other side of that now. And I think that weightlifting has actually been a really big part of that. Not because I'm going to the Olympics or anything like that, but because I realize that I'm not all academics, and that I can rebound from failure, and that I have so many other gifts to share with the world. And I have so many other ways that I can translate the types of things that I was working on in graduate school that are around these same kinds of issues about marginalized people, marginalized bodies, and just put that in a new package for people to understand. So I think that's one of the stumbling blocks, and I'm happy to say that I'm on the other side of that. I still have some grad school regret from time to time, but seeing that I've been able to create new things has provided a lot of hope for what my future academic endeavors might be. And then I think just in terms of like sports in general, like one of the things I'm really struggling with now as far as Big Girl Barbell is how much of like the current climate I need to be putting into the brand. Like it's obviously Black owned. I'm a Black woman. I deal with these issues that it feels like the rest of the world is kind of just waking up to every day. Like that's my life. Do I want to go on to Instagram and still deal with those issues in that way? And I don't know the answer to that lately. One of the things I've been exploring is the idea of Black joy when the world is falling apart. And on my own personal Instagram, that's kind of the life I'm living now, with discovering some a newfound love and appreciation of the outdoors. So I'm living a joyful life, you know, amidst all the muck and the ugliness. So one of the things I've been thinking about is what role Big Girl Barbell plays in mediating some of these bigger issues. And is it enough for me to be a Black woman who obviously is all about Black liberation, but how much do I need of that to bring into the brand? Not because like I'm concerned about the brand, because I'm not concerned about the brand, but just like in terms of my own mental toll and the, you know, how it wears on me. Do I also want that my online space to be like that as well? Because it's suffocating and it's claustrophobic, if that makes sense.
So the final question is that we ask all the guests, how we always wrap up, is because you clearly are doing really cool stuff, it's neat, like we talked about, see the twists and turns and how increasingly, and it's constant or still evolving to do some really powerful, awesome stuff that's really impacting people's lives in the different ways. And a lot of people have not found that convergence of passions or you know, are not in that place in life. So sometimes it's just takes time. It's just circumstance or whatever. But what sort of advice would you give to people who maybe either don't know what their passions are yet and are trying to find them, or do know what their passions are but don't know how to go after it, or are sort of scared to take a chance or whatever it may be? What would you tell these folks? Take your time. Let the wisdom flow.
Well, so my current job is I work with students who are going to apply to college. So it could be seniors, but it could also be kids as young as like ninth grade. And part of that work is getting them to explore some interests they have and to take some risks to try things that they might want to try. I always tell my students, I say, just try. If it doesn't work out, we'll pretend it never happened. We'll move on to something else. But that's also how I live my own life. I mean, I'm 40 and I just started playing the cello last year. I'm doing, you know, weightlifting. I'm still in the gym. I'm hiking. I'm doing all these things that I just want to do. I will say that I have some ability to do those things. I'm married, my husband works. I work. I was raised pretty comfortably by my family. I've got 2 Ivy League degrees. So I have freedom to try some things, and if they don't work, they don't work. I'll rebound. And I realize that everybody doesn't have that kind of like safety net to do those things. So I want to take some time to just recognize that. That said, I do think that there are ways that people can push themselves a little bit. I don't even know if I quite believe in the idea of passions. Because even I will have passions, but then I'll be over the passion. Like, I was passionate about grad school until I wasn't passionate anymore. So I think part of it is allowing yourself time to feel something. When the feeling is gone, keep it moving and try something else. And I think a lot of times people think that whatever decisions they make have to be lifelong decisions, or they have to be some things that they keep doing forever, or else it didn't count. So I think part of it is like getting out of this like all or nothing thinking. I also think that people have short memories. Like, okay, you try something, it doesn't work out, just forget it ever happened. Like, I could go through and erase Big Girl Barbell today and nobody would talk about it next year, and it would be a thing that I did, but now I'm on to something else. So don't be afraid to try something and just see what happens. But I think also, like, there's almost always a way to make things happen, even if you have to put it off for a while. Like, I wanted to do cello since 5th grade, and I just started at 39. So sometimes you gotta put it off and come back to it. But just be, it sounds so cliche, but it's so true. You just have to be willing to be scared and step into the fear. And it's okay to be scared, and it's okay not to be good at something. I think that's the other thing. Like, if you talk to kids are so fearless. They will do anything. They will jump off a jungle gym. They'll ride a roller coaster. They just do all sorts of things. And something happens to us when we get old, when the fear takes over from the decision-making. Some of that's self-preservation, but some of it I think also holds us back. So be willing to be scared. Be willing to make a mistake. Be willing to be the only one, like, for weeks, the only people that was commenting on Big Girl Barbell was my brother and my mother. So I was like, go on, say something, write a comment that says, way to go, girl, or something, like, to get it going. Like, be okay with being the only person who's doing something. Yeah.
Great. I really, of course, that ties into everything. It's a good sort of summary, because where we're at currently, really, one of our sayings too with our business is comfort with discomfort. Mm. And it's like, I think it's one of the sobering parts of adulthood is,
yeah,
you just realize, and of course, privilege plays into it so much. You always try to keep that perspective on things and realize what you got and being grateful for what you got. But I think almost more importantly, it's like, it doesn't matter what you got. Life is also just hard, and there's tough things and sad things and depressing things. And especially, like, again, what the country's dealing with now and tackling, like, very important but very uncomfortable issues of racism and confronting our country's racist founding and racist history for hundreds and hundreds of years, is, it is uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
It's way more uncomfortable to have lived it as a person of color than to think about it as a white person, but it's discomfort that you got to embrace. And so it's like, the world is very uncomfortable right now, from to tackling racist things, like, so get used to it.
Yeah.
Not being afraid of discomfort is very important.
Yeah.
Well, we're very grateful for you, everything you're doing, and for being willing to come and talk to me today.
Thank you for reaching out. I really appreciate it. I'm trying to spread the big girl gospel, so this was very good, and I'm glad to have this opportunity. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I love everything you shared. Really, really happy to hear your perspectives and your work. We'll try to spread the gospel as much as we can.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. I hope to talk to you soon.
Yeah. Sure thing. Bye.
Bye.
This wraps up another edition of
the Get After It PDX podcast.
For more information about today's guest, including social media links, please check out the show notes for this episode. Thanks for listening. Now it's your turn to get out there
and get after it.